Hello again. Welcome back to another edition of the Tomahawk Nation Hoops Dedicated Podcast. I am Matt Minnick, and as always, joined by Michael Rogner. And once again, Michael, we are coming here to record after a pair of wins. I feel like this is becoming a habit, and that's because Florida State's won, what, eight out of their last nine out of their last 10, maybe, games. But another two wins on the board. This time against Pittsburgh on the road, which is, you know, maybe something we can talk about as a rarity, and then Miami on the road, which is not has not been a rarity lately.
Yeah, this is starting to feel a little bit like last year, you know, where we struggled a little bit early going in the season, and then it just got rolling. And it seems like every time we talked, it was, you know, after beating somebody. You know, and hopefully this season ends with an actual tournament, so we can talk about the really fun wins.
Yeah, you know, maybe we should go back. I feel like since we started the podcast in December ish of 2019, or maybe November of 2019, I don't know. We're coming up here, closing in on our 40th episode. Since we started the podcast, Florida State's basketball record has to be pretty impressed, maybe the best 40 game stretch ever. So
yeah, it's like 32 and 5 or 32 and 6 or something.
Yeah, you know, Seminole Nation, you know, you're welcome.
All right.
So what can we say? So Florida State went up to Pittsburgh. So coming off the huge thrashing against UVA, which was wonderful. And exciting. We talked about that. We previewed the Pittsburgh game saying that I think we both predicted a win. And actually, I feel like yours was pretty close to being spot on. So kudos there. But both of us saying, you know, this felt like a game that if they could just execute what they needed to execute and keep Pitt, you know, from just going crazy on the foul line, that, you know, Florida State should be able to win. And Florida State basically went up and took care of business.
Yeah, this game kind of showed, you know, where Florida State is offensively. Like we did not shoot well against Pitt. We only made 4 of 14 threes, but we were just so efficient, you know, outside of that, Pitt scored 72 and I think a 71 possession game, which is pretty solid for them. But it was just, you know, our offense was simply just too much, you know, and if we continue to play at that level, you know, it makes it really hard for sort of the mediocre teams like, you know, Pitt and I don't know who else would be in there, but you know, for those teams to be able to match up, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a tough matchup with Florida State when, you know, you're facing a top 10 offense.
Yeah, no, you're right. They, Florida State really manufactured, I feel like, points pretty well. There wasn't that one guy who went off. I mean, I guess Wyatt was 2 of 4 from 3 in 6 minutes, or not 6 minutes, 13 minutes, sorry. I was looking at the first half, but so that's nice. But you know, yeah, they really had to manufacture them. Raekwon Evans actually was able to just break people down off the dribble, get into the paint a lot. He had a nice day getting to the free throw line, and the team didn't turn the ball over, which was something I think that caught my eye. They only about a 15% turnover rate, which is, you know, that's that rate where it's like, okay, we had some turnovers trying to make something happen, maybe trying to make a play or, you know, be aggressive to the hoop, caught a charge, but not so many turnovers that you're actually now, you know, preventing yourself from running your offense.
Yeah. And we've talked about it in previous pods, you know, the difference in a lot of these games is just kind of how well our bench plays. And when we get production from our bench, then it's, you know, pretty much lights out for everybody. And, you know, against Pitt, you know, we scored, you know, 30 something points off the bench, which is certainly not anything like we scored against Miami. But, you know, a number of good guys came in and put in valuable minutes, and, you know, Sadar Calhoun and Balsa and Scotty and Polite, you know, that they all played valuable minutes, which, you know, when we're talking about Florida State's depth, you know, if they're really going like 11 deep, then yeah, they're going to be an awfully difficult out.
Yeah. And the defense too, I don't know that the defense played extremely well, but it was so we talked a lot about Justin Champagne going into the game, and he, I mean, he for all intents and purposes, he could be the ACC player of the year. We'll see what happens if Pitt slides here and finishes, you know, in the bottom three or four of the conference. That might put a squash on that. But you know, it's interesting. So Champagne was the KenPom MVP, which you know, doesn't is is a little uncommon for a losing team to have the KenPom MVP, although Miami also had it the next game. And he did score 21 points, which was the most points scored by any player in the game. But you know, it came on 17 shots. So you know, while he had 21 and 10 across 40 minutes, I feel like that's a good enough job on a guy who is first team all ACC.
Yeah, and if you look at his game, he played all 40 minutes, you know, which as a coach, that's a tough thing to ask somebody to do, especially when nobody at on Florida State even played 30 minutes. And you know, Pitt made their little run with you know 12 minutes or so left in the second half, and I think they cut it to four. And then you know, Florida State was just you know never let them get over the hump. And a lot of it is probably because you know Champagne was a little tired. He you know he took 17 shots and only made seven, so he scored some points, you know, but a lot of that came at the free throw line, and you know he got a double double, but he does that every night.
Right.
And then the other guys, you know, they had like three other guys that all played 32 to 36 minutes, which is pretty rough against Florida State.
Yeah, and you kind of hit the. I mean, we've talked about it on the pod before, and you know, you're right. In the second half, Pitt cut it to maybe four, even at one point, but they definitely cut it to five or six a few times, and they just never got, you know, the lead. And you know, we talked about it against who was it? Maybe Wake Forest. But if you're going to make a comeback, you've got to take that lead. You know, it's if you only just keep getting close, and then the team kind of you know the team you're chasing extends it a little bit, you're just gonna run out of energy, because it takes a lot of energy just to get back to the tied game. And then if you don't ever take that lead and actually make the other team think, "Wow, we can lose the game," it just, you know, eventually you run out of energy, run out of gas.
Yeah, it's just that psychological thing. If you're, you know, if you're shooting alone in a gym and you're kind of hitting threes, but you're back rimming most of them, you're really close, you know, but you just kind of lose your confidence. And I think at some point, if you don't take the lead, then you know, you're kind of feeling like you got a loss coming.
Yeah, I mean, not I guess a not a very profound statement to say that if you don't take the lead, you're gonna lose the game. But more to the point of, if you never even if there's 8 minutes to go, 6 minutes to go, and you just can't get over that hump, you know, I usually more often than not, we see, especially a deep team like Florida State, pull away in the last 3 to 4 minutes. So maybe moving on to Miami, which for the second time playing Miami this year just was not. I mean, the game was over. I think Josh Pick in the Slack channel said like the game was over by the second media timeout. I mean, it was at that point, it was clear that it was going to be a name your score kind of game for Florida State.
Yeah, we went on a 25-4 run, you know, like a couple minutes into the game, and that was pretty much it. And if you look at the minute distribution, you know, there are a lot of guys getting more minutes than they're used to, and you know, the starters not getting as many minutes as they're used to. So we could have beaten Miami by, you know, whatever we felt like, and it was pretty much a scrimmage for the last 30 minutes of the game.
Yeah, and a scrimmage that unfortunately saw, you know, Malik Osborne get hurt. That might be the biggest news of all coming from the Miami game. I don't know how much to take away from the actual play, although I will say that every game it looks like Sadar Calhoun is getting a little bit more comfortable, and you know, he's a guy that, you know, in the beginning of this year we even debated, you know, will Scotty Barnes or Sadar Calhoun over their entire Florida State career have a larger impact at FSU, if Calhoun comes back next year and maybe takes that second year leap. You know, that could actually be a legit debate. But every game he starts to get a little more comfortable, and it was great to see him have that first half where he was really just, you know, efficient, 5 for 6 from the floor, I think, active on defense, not necessarily always in the right place, but active on defense, getting teammates involved, moving without the basketball. He had a really nice kind of pass and relocation that Scotty then got it back to him for a deep three. If you watch the Golden State Warriors, which we have talked about on this podcast before, of how, you know, that's a team that, given Luke Laux's position there and just some of the relationships the staff has, like, Golden State is a team that we've sort of tried to bring some of their traits into our offense, and pass and relocate for a three is definitely a staple of the Golden State offense. So it was good to see Calhoun doing that. But other than that, I felt like maybe the biggest takeaway is, like, what's the status of Malik Osborne?
Yeah, and, it, you know, looking at it on film, it didn't look that bad. So I'm hoping, and Ham didn't really say much in the post game besides, you know, he turned his ankle. So I'm hoping that he's ready for North Carolina. But, you know, Ham is so cautious, you know, mm-hmm. with injuries, that if Malik is banged up at all, he's not going to play him. And you know, at it, with his size, you know, 6'9", 225, you know, we really need that against North Carolina. So hopefully he'll be, you know, fired up and ready to go and healthy. And, you know, the same goes for MJ Walker. You know, he sat out Miami because we knew that we could win without him. And hopefully that means that he is physically, you know, ready for North Carolina.
Yeah, you're spot on. Hamilton is he's extremely conservative with the two foul participation in the first half, and he's extremely conservative, you know, bringing guys back before they're ready from injury. And hey, look, we're coming. You want to win in March, so today's February 25th. You know, I'd much rather have Malik Osborne healthy for the first round of the NCAA tournament than I care about him being healthy for a road game at UNC. But I think when we get later in the podcast to the UNC preview, I think it's a pretty valuable point in terms of, yeah, going to play a team that has legitimate bigs like De'Ron Sharp, you know, that having Malik Osborne available would certainly make that game easier. Whether it's a win or loss without him, I don't know. Maybe we can talk more about that later. Anything else from the Miami game that feels noteworthy to you? I mean, Raekwon Gray can kind of continues his, I don't know, like, he's just turned into a double-double machine, I feel like.
Yeah, 13 boards, 12 points. I mean, he is just a hell of a basketball player right now, and 6 assists. It's... You know, a month ago, we weren't really talking about the chances of Raekwon Gray, this being his last year, but now that's a legit conversation. It's just the consistency is there, which is, you know, what you want to see from upperclassmen. It's not like he's having, you know, a blow-up game every 3 or 4 games. He's just consistently right there. You know, this is third double-double in the last 6 games, I think. And you know, every one of those games, he's just been a really solid performer. You mentioned, you know, Sadar Calhoun, the light kind of coming on for him, and, you know, the same thing has happened with Raekwon Gray at a different level. You know, it's just the light has clearly come on, and he understands what he can do with the ball inside of, you know, say 15 feet, and he's going out and he's doing it. So kudos to him.
Yeah, that's really well said. It is like that light has come on. Just the difference of being, you know, Sadar Calhoun's gone from uncomfortable to comfortable in a college, in a D1 ACC college basketball game. And Raekwon Gray has gone from, like, a solid player to the best player on the team night in and night out. So
yeah, it's hard to be the best player on the, you know, it's a lot of, not everybody can do it, you know, and Gray clearly has the mental capacity to, you know, to be able to do it.
Well, and you can just, some of these, like that block he had, that's just not a play he could physically make a couple of years ago, to run back on D and get up and make a play at the rim. So it's been a mental transformation and a physical transformation. You know, that floater that he's added is just deadly for a guy his size. So it's been a real, real treat and a pleasure to watch Raekwon Gray. Selfishly, I hope we get one more year to watch him. Realistically, I don't know. That feels to me like maybe 50-50 at best. But we've got the rest of this season to at least enjoy for sure. I'll throw out one other thing about this game. It's sort of under the radar, but both of these both of these wins were on the road, and for a team that is, you know, hoping to not be on the 4 or 5 seed line, we'll probably talk about that here in a second, but that's important. Florida State had only played 3 road games of the season prior to the Pitt game. And that's one of those things that, first of all, winning on the road literally counts more in the net. Like you actually get credit for more than one win in the net rankings, and the net rankings are a large component of how the committee decides seeds. So when you go and beat Pitt on the road, you're given credit for 1.4 of a win to the record keeping on the net. Compared to a home win where you're only given credit for 0.6. So it literally counts more. And on top of that, they look at things like the quad one and the quad two records, and beating Pitt on the road is, depending on what their ranking is, they're right on that cut line, but it's either quad one or quad two on any given day. Whereas beating Pitt at home is at best quad two and maybe quad three. So if you're into the seeding at all, you know, it's not a bad thing that FSU has been going on the road and beating teams that they are better than.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad we're kind of finishing up with some games on the road, because we've only played, I think, 5 times away from home. You know, people keep harping on Alabama and their resume and why are they ranked so high. And if you look at their schedule, they've played like 12 or 13 times away from home. So it means a lot in college basketball to be able to travel and pick up wins.
Yeah, absolutely. Ohio State is a team, you know, maybe this is a good segue. So actually I'm going to hold off here, just for a second. Anything else then on the Pitt or Miami comfortable wins?
I'll just say about Miami, you know, the announcers never shut up about their injuries. You know, everybody has injuries, and Miami's are probably worse than most, but whatever. The Canes are about to have their 3rd straight losing season. You know, Larinaga's been there 10 years, and now they're about to have their 3rd straight losing season. Florida State hasn't had a losing season in like 16 years. So you kind of got to wonder if I doubt it would happen in a COVID year, but you know, Larinaga has got to figure out what's going on at Miami. They're just sort of a mess of a program right now.
His roster management has been pretty poor. A lot of transfers, a lot of guys that honestly maybe weren't a great fit for each other to play well together. And I don't know, frankly though, if I had my wishes come true, Mike White and Larinaga would coach at UF and UM respectively for the next 10 more years. So yeah, I'll take Hamilton beating up on those two any day. All right, we are gonna do a segment here where Michael reached out on Twitter and asked for some questions, some comments. We also had some questions at Tomahawk Nation in the comments section. So we are going to answer some of those, a little mailbag action here. We'll take a 1-week pause from the and one segment. And I think, Michael, this is really a true smattering here, but, and you know, some of them might require more in-depth answers than others. And we can both take them as they come. I'll start off with perhaps an easy one. And let me say ahead of time, I would like to read names out so people can feel like they had their question answered. If I mess up the pronunciation of your name, I apologize. You can come onto the comments at TN and correct me, please. And next time I'll get it wrong. But Rishi Malhotra asks, if we win out, are we most likely a 2 seed, or is a 1 seed possible? And I should say that a number of folks were asking about this question. So like, what is sort of the ceiling for our NCAA tournament seed? I'll let you start. And then I think that kind of goes back into what we were talking about with the net and maybe the road games and stuff.
Yeah, it feels like 3 of the 1 seeds are locked up: Gonzaga, Baylor, and Michigan. The 4th one is up for debate at this point, and we could get there by winning out, but it would require some teams in front of us to you know, not do this. If we win out and Villanova wins out, you know, Villanova is going to get that number 1 seed. You could probably say the same thing for Houston and like Ohio State maybe. So we could get there, but it's extremely unlikely.
Yeah, I think I think I agree. Maybe our maybe our def I don't know what your definition of extremely unlikely is. I'd put it in maybe the I don't know, 15% category, which I guess that could be extremely unlikely. I agree that Gonzaga and Baylor are, I mean, they're locked in, they're one seeds, and Michigan probably is a one seed. I guess there's a world where Michigan could lose like three out of their last four or five, and I don't know, maybe drop, but I think realistically they're a one seed. The rest, you know, this goes back to what we're talking about net. So look at Ohio State. Ohio State is 9-4 in quad one games as of right now. Now, you know, net and quad one wins and stuff like that are all fluid. They change every single day as the rankings change, but they have 9 quad one wins. Florida State only has 8 quad one and two wins together. Now, part of that's because Florida State's only played 17 games and Ohio State has played 23. But I mean, at some point, you only have your resume to bring to the table. So Ohio State right now just has, you know, more heft in their resume than Florida State. You know, Illinois probably has more heft in their resume despite being 16-6. They're 7-5 in quad one games and 4-1 in quad two games. You know, you mentioned Villanova. Surprisingly, they're only 2-1 in the quad one. Part of that is because, like Florida State, they've only played, you know, 18, they've played less than 20 games. So maybe, you know, if you put us together heads up with each other, yeah, maybe if they lose one more, you could make an argument for us. Same for maybe Houston, who is only 2-1 in quad and only quad one and 4-1 in quad two. Again, playing in not a mid-major conference, but not one of the top four conferences in the AAC. But all that is to say, I think, yeah, if we win out, I think two seed probably feels right. All right, so we've got another. So maybe sticking with the top teams themes, there were several people. We'll say so. Michael Collins asked, "How does FSU match up with Gonzaga or Baylor if they ended up playing in the tournament?" And other people asked similar questions around, like, what, you know, against these top teams. Let's call it Gonzaga, Baylor, Michigan, Ohio State, Alabama. How does Florida State, in your eyes, match up?
Well, I think there's probably four teams that we want to avoid, and that would be Gonzaga, Baylor, Michigan, and Iowa. Gonzaga and Baylor are just on another level. I mean, they are elite on both ends of the floor, and so even, you know, even if we're playing well, it's like they're going to score a ton of points against our defense, which is not that good, and we would just have to have absolutely everything go right to beat them. Michigan and Iowa, I'm mostly concerned about their bigs. You know, both of them have, you know, probably two of the most skilled bigs in the country. And if we're, you know, the defense that we want to play, we want to be switching one through five. And if we're switching, you know, MJ Walker onto Hunter Dickinson of Michigan, you know, that's a problem. We have the potential to just get abused and would have to, you know, really think about the way that we play defense and probably play it a little bit differently than we've been practicing all year, you know, which is never a good thing.
Is it weird that I'd maybe rather play Gonzaga than Michigan? Hunter Dickinson, I mean, geez, can we just dream for a moment? We were it was Michigan and Florida State were his top two. It was down to us in Michigan. If that guy came here, I can't even imagine. I mean, we'd have him and Bolsa and Gray and Osborne and Scotty. I mean, the length would just be unbelievable. But is it weird that I'd rather say, well, I feel like maybe we can be physical with Gonzaga and create a switching defense with length that puts pressure on a freshman Jalen Suggs at point guard, even though he's been great and might be the number one pick in the draft, than facing a team like Michigan and Hunter Dickinson?
Yeah, I think if you look at Gonzaga and Baylor, like they've been elite since the season began. Michigan, you know, is not that way. You know, they didn't really play anybody in out of conference. They had to go to overtime to beat Oakland. You know, they were kind of struggling heading into Big Ten play, and now they're just, you know, they're just beating the pants off everybody they play. I think, you know, they've won what, 12 out of 13 Big Ten games, which is not an easy conference to be playing in. and they are just playing at a super high level. And it's primarily because they got all this talent surrounding Hunter Dickinson, who's if you're not familiar with him, he's like a 20-year-old freshman. I don't know how they get that old, but you know, he's a grown man, even though he's a freshman, and he is very quickly moving up the ranks of sort of the national player of the year conversation. So yeah, I would agree with you that we want to avoid Michigan. I don't know that I would agree that we want to avoid them more than Gonzaga. Gonzaga is I think our past success against them, you know, maybe tinges the conversation a little bit, you know, but this is a much tougher team to bully than the one that we beat in the tournament a couple of years ago.
That's probably fair. This definitely looks like the best Gonzaga team that Mark Few's ever put on the court. Maybe let's look at the two seeds, the other teams that maybe feel like a step below the trio at the top. The Ohio States, the Villanovas, the Alabama. I mean, do you think that if Florida State plays their A game, would the A games of the other teams beat Florida State?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that we would need some help against Villanova. Other than that, I think we would beat all those teams if we bring our A game. Villanova has just the capability. They shoot so many threes. You know, it's like nobody scores as much from three as they do. And if they get hot, it doesn't really matter if we play our A game or not. It's just, you know, taking 40 threes and making 20 of them, you're going to win the game.
Yeah, that's so. As I phrased the question, I think you're probably right. If they play their A or A plus game, I mean, gosh, I guess they could beat anyone in the tournament. Let me ask you this then: that if Florida State plays its A game, so let's say, you know, either the UVA game or maybe the Louisville game, pick your poison, or maybe even the home game against NC State. If Florida State plays their A game, and the top trio of teams plays their B game, they just don't have one of their guys is just off, gets into foul trouble. Can Florida State's A game beat the B game of Baylor, Gonzaga, Michigan?
I think we can for Baylor. And the reason is that they are the best shooting team in the country. And if they're playing their B game, it means that they're not hitting threes at probably the rate that they're used to. You know, and that's just that's a big part of their offense. You know, it opens up everything that they're trying to do. And if, you know, guys like Jared Butler and Davion Mitchell and the long-haired kid, Matthew Meyer, you know, if they're not hitting threes, then yeah, absolutely. I think our A game beats their B game.
All right. I think I agree. West Virginia is a team we didn't talk about. And I think it's time that we move on to the next question, but they're another one that I don't know, maybe when people ask the question of, oh, how does FSU stack up against the top teams? Folks better keep an eye on West Virginia, because Bob Huggins knows how to get it done in March. I mean, he doesn't have a title, but he certainly knows how to win games in March. So that'd be a sneaky one to watch out for, too. There was a question about MJ Walker, and just if and when he comes back healthy, would he join the starting lineup? And if so, who would he replace? I think we would both agree, yes, he absolutely rejoins the starting lineup, right?
Yeah, he's been a starter since the very beginning of his sophomore year. So he is clearly comfortable starting games.
Okay. And so then who he might replace, I guess, you know, that could be determined by, is Osborne healthy? You know, and maybe looking at the matchups, I think it's possible that a Polite maybe goes to the bench, or a Wyatt. But I don't know. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I thought maybe when Polite came back that he would be starting games, but he started yesterday because, you know, MJ wasn't healthy, but Wyatt has kind of held on to that starting spot. And Polite's playing more minutes, you know, so it's always key to the conversation when we're talking about starters.
Absolutely.
You know, just because you start doesn't mean you're gonna play more than 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But you know, I see MJ kind of taking Wyatt's spot, you know, that corner shooter that, you know, is spacing the floor that we're really looking for.
Yeah, it's almost like Hamilton has been liking to come out and see if Wyatt's hot. Like, oh, let me see. Let him take three shots real quick, and if he's making it, good. It's a good game. And then if not, he gets the yank. All right, maybe one more here. There was a good one, and I'm trying to find. Here it is. J. Blake Seaman, or has Ken Pom tended to slightly underrate FSU over the past few seasons, and does FSU's deep rotation suppress more statistical dominance? Thoughts here?
I don't think so. I mean, the rotations is the rotation. It's how we play the game. So we're not, Ken Pom isn't just evaluating your starters. It's evaluating your entire game. I think if it was underrating Florida State, we would see that reflected in, Vegas line betting lines. And it's not. It's still whatever Ken Pom has is usually within a half point of the Vegas line, and we would see some difference. I think where Ken Pom needs some tweaking is it overrates teams that play really slow.
That's your last point, I think, is a good one. And I think we've talked about that before with UVA and others, Notre Dame when they had some of their slow burn offenses. But to the question that was asked, I don't know. I think I might zig where you zag. Your point about the Vegas ratings is good. I think there's a different way to answer this question. Is it underrating how many points we're actually going to win the game by? I don't think so. I think that is probably accurate, and the Vegas lines would bear that out. And that is because the depth is the way we play. The depth is part of our strategy. Is it underrating the actual ability of our team in a one game setting? I think maybe. I think. So Florida State definitely plays. So we're 20th in the country in bench minutes, which, as an aside, has significantly increased from earlier in the year when we were a little bit concerned about the amount of minutes that our starters were playing. So 20th in the country in bench minutes. And more than that, with FSU shooting the way they've been shooting, particularly at home, they've jumped out to such big leads. 20 points last night against Miami. The NC State and Clemson home games or Georgia Tech, these massive 20, 25 point leads that I feel like, because we rely on depth as a strategy, there is even more liberal substitution in those big games. And you see these second halves where the score could have been, if we were a team that just only played seven guys no matter what, or eight guys no matter what, probably we win by 35. We don't. We play 12. So I think where I'm going with it is, I think Ken Pom accurately predicts that we might win a game by 16 because we're gonna play more guys and the score kind of comes back to what it would be. But does that then holistically just slightly underrate us for how, what's our ceiling, maybe? What is the top ceiling of a one game performance in which our top eight guys played 33 to 34 minutes?
Yeah, it'd be interesting to pose that question to him if you could ever get a realistic answer out of him. Is he coaching with the regular season in mind in a different way that he'll be coaching, in the postseason when it's winter or go home? It's an interesting question, and I think that we could probably, talk for an hour about how the sausage is made, but at some point you just gotta kind of have an answer, and I think that will split the difference on this one.
Fair enough. All right, one final question, and then we'll go to a quick break. This one comes from Aaron at FSU Aaron 80 at Aaron FSU 85. What is the ideal coaching path for FSU? So referencing when Hamilton's retiring, should we target someone internally or externally?
Who can say? I mean, this is one of those things that every time a coach gets hired, everybody who covers basketball has a very strong opinion about whether or not it's a good hire or not. And then, 3 years later, everybody's kind of forgotten what those opinions were. People thought that, Willie was a great hire for the football team, and turns out maybe not. But from my perspective, I think that what Coach Ham has been able to cover up, you know, to bury the bones in the backyard, is the fact that Florida State is getting boat raced by a lot of teams when it comes to spending. And so if we were to go out and target some, you know, hot young coach, I don't think that we could keep him here if they were very successful. You know, if there were bigger programs that wanted him, it would become a stepping stone job. So I'm almost looking for a coach with a similar resume to like Ham or even Jim Larranaga, where they're looking for a place to kind of finish their career. You know, and if all goes well, they're going to be here 10 or 12 years and then, you know, sail off into the sunset. And, you know, we're seeing the same thing with Hamilton, except that he's going to be here 20 plus years, you know, you know, my targeting young guys, I think is going to be a mistake for this program.
Yeah. I don't know that I certainly wouldn't want to target the hot young coach that has no real connection to Florida State. And yeah, Hamilton 20 plus. I mean, when it was 2010, I thought, well, surely by 20, you know, 16 or 17, Hamilton will have, you know, called it a career, a wonderful career, and rode off into the sunset. And here we are at 2021, and he, I mean, looks like he could at least go another 5 years. So, you know, this question maybe. The answer to this question may be radically different by the time Hamilton actually hangs it up in another decade or two. But I think Dennis Gates is an interesting name because he, first of all, great job by him up at, was it Cleveland State? I mean, he has really, in just 2 years or so, turned around the program and has to be the shoe-in for the coach of the year in his conference. But you know, he's someone who gets it in Tallahassee. He understands what kind of administration and, you know, revenue sources he'd be looking at. He understands the talent base that's in sort of the Atlanta, South Florida, Mount Verde area. And I wonder if his experience here would lend him to want to stay here more and not have it be a straight up stepping stone job. So that sort of blends that like internal external combo. Other than that, though, I really would say that I would just want someone who has head coaching experience. We've seen even with Dennis Gates, I'd want him to coach somewhere a little bit higher than Cleveland State. We've just seen so many guys come into the ACC who, you know, looked like they were doing great things at you name the mid-major program and the ACC just spits him up and chews him out. And whereas Hamilton, you know, he had coached in the Big East before, he had coached in the Big Eight before as a head coach. So he was very familiar with what it meant to build a winning program in a power conference. And I think when you're competing against Duke, North Carolina, Syracuse, Louisville, Virginia, Notre Dame, Georgia Tech, you better have more experience than just, you know, coaching in the Sun Belt.
Yeah, I agree with everything you say about Dennis Gates, and yeah, he has done a fantastic job, you know, winning the Horizon League regular season this year. So good for him. I think that the one other thing that I would look for is you know, something either offensively or defensively that is different from what everybody else does. You know, our defense, you know, fronting the post, playing 94 feet of pressure, you know, forcing teams to initiate their offense so far from the basket, switching everything. You know, it's a hard thing to prepare for on short notice because it's not like everybody else's defense. And so I would want to see a coach coming into Florida State that is difficult to prepare for, you know, when you've only got a 2-day turnaround.
Yeah, I would hope that we actually keep that defense. I really like forcing teams to do play in a way that messes them up from their rhythm. Like, don't just let a team come down and just get into their offense and run their sets. I'll throw a name out there that I wouldn't want. Just, I don't know, Andy Enfield. No offense to the guy, but USC actually seems pretty good this year. They should be. They're one of the top 10 talented teams in the country this year. They have the guy who also could, you know, I mentioned Jalen Suggs, but Evan Mobley could legit be the number one pick in the NBA draft. I don't, I just don't, they seem soft. They, up until this, they really don't seem to be that interested in playing defense a lot of times. I don't know. I would say I'd pass on him, but I am not the, I'm certainly not going to be the person that's in position making the decision. All right, why don't we go to a quick commercial break and come back with a preview of Florida State's third consecutive road game going up to Chapel Hill to face the Tar Heels.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, we are back. So if you missed, we just did a mailbag segment that was pretty fun. We'll have to do that again, maybe a few podcasts from now. But that was good, good stuff. And we are now going to transition into the next game on the season, which is traveling to Chapel Hill on Saturday for a road game against North Carolina Tar Heels. It's a North Carolina team, Michael, that honestly was looking pretty good. They had beaten Duke, which I know laugh, but Duke's actually been playing better the last few weeks. They lost to Virginia on the road, but a lot of teams lose Virginia in Charlottesville. And they beat a bad Northeastern team and then smashed Louisville as Louisville was coming out of their COVID pause. And then they added a quick game to the schedule. They had a game canceled that they were surely going to beat BC, and they added Marquette at the last minute at home and got beat by double digits by kind of a mediocre Marquette team.
Yeah, that was dumb. That was a dumb game to schedule. Kudos to them for trying to find an extra game, but you do not schedule a quad three team that's capable of beating you, you know, which is exactly what they did. And now they have a home loss, you know, a quad three loss, and they're already, you know, kind of they're on the right side of the bubble for now, but if they, you know, if they finish the season slowly, you know, that game could end up costing them, you know, a trip to the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, it very well could. And now it also, you know, Ham even said today, or maybe it was yesterday, but, oh, you know, now we're going to be going to face an angry North Carolina team. I don't know if they're angry or not, but I will definitely say that, you know, they understand, I think, the moment that it is where you have a top 10 team, top 11 team coming into your house. And it's really, you know, one of your last chances of the year to get that victory that might put you back on the right side of the bubble.
Yeah, and I kind of agree with that a little bit. I mean, but if you're relying on that, if you need that to get up for, you know, hosting Florida State, you know, it's probably a sign of a bigger problem. I would expect North Carolina to be prepared, you know, either way.
I given their performances last year, where they finished last in the entire conference, maybe that is a sign of bigger trouble. Maybe it is a sign that, hey, that the fact that North Carolina needs to be backed into a corner with their NCAA tournament hopes, you know, kind of on the line against the number one team in the conference coming into their building. Maybe that's a sign that Roy Williams has, you know, lost a little bit of the culture there, but nonetheless, we are traveling to North Carolina. They are coming off a loss against Marquette. They will be looking for a win. You know, we talked a little bit about if we'd like to have Malik Osborne in this game. North Carolina is the number two offensive rebounding team in the country. They really don't do anything else well on offense. They're not a good three-point shooting team. They're not a good free throw shooting team. In terms of percentage, they have the ball stolen from them quite a bit. The freshman point guard has looked like a freshman point guard quite often. But, man, they erase a lot of mistakes by cleaning up the offensive glass.
Yeah, and if you look back at that first game when we beat them by seven, you know, they did a lot of things well in that game that they don't normally do well. Most notably, they hit a bunch of threes. You know, and they're not a good shooting team. But we were able to hold them to just 13 offensive rebounds. And I say just, but for North Carolina, that's actually below their average. You know, they rebounded 38% of their own misses, and, you know, on the season they're at 39. So the key to beating them, you know, is certainly keeping away those second chance opportunities. And I would be surprised if they can shoot the ball well enough, if they're not getting offensive rebounds, you know, to really, you know, handle Florida State.
Yeah, and the main guy is Dayron Sharp. They've got a triumvirate of big men, but Dayron Sharp is the 265-pound freshman, and that's probably when he's skipped breakfast. But you know, he's second in the country at offensive rebounding percentage. He grabs you know, over 18% of the available rebounds, offensive rebounds, when he's on the court. That's doing some things. So if Osborne doesn't play, let's just say that we both agree that Osborne, you know, that Hamilton treats it cautiously and gives him, you know, maybe a week off or a week and a half off with BC coming up next. Do you try to drop a guy like Gray down onto Sharp? Do you hope that Balsa can play foul free minutes? I don't know. How do you react to that?
Yeah, you got to, when the shot's in the air, you got to have two bodies on him. I mean, he's gonna out rebound anybody that we just, if Gray's trying to box him out, he's gonna be Gray for the rebound most more often than not. So you have to have a couple of guys on him, which our defense kind of sets up well for that because we're fronting the post anyway. You know, so you've already got one defender there, and then you should have the help side behind him. You know, against Louisville, he had 8 offensive rebounds, and that's not even the first time that he's had 8 offensive rebounds this year in an ACC game. Yeah, so he is, you know, capable of being a game changer and basically winning the game on his own. He's just such a big, you know, powerful guy, you know, even as a freshman. And then, you know, that's not even, you know, talking about Baycott or Garrison Brooks are both pretty good offensive rebounders in their own right. You know, and two more guys that we have to watch out for. It's just this game is you know, the coaches are going to be preaching rebounding, and we'll see how well Florida State is able to execute.
Yeah, it really is an embarrassment of riches for Roy Williams down underneath. But guard play has, you know, which was long the staple of a North Carolina basketball team, guard play has let them down. You mentioned that they're not a good shooting team. I mean, there's one guy that shoots with any volume who's even over, I'm looking here, even over 35%. Now, Kerwin Walton is 45%. He's 44 for 97 on the year. So, you know, he's the guy that in the scouting report, it's going to be locate Kerwin Walton on the perimeter. You cannot let him get an open look. But everybody else, I mean, like I said, they don't even have another guy over 35%.
Yeah, he kind of broke out talking about Kerwin Walton. He kind of broke out against Florida State. You know, he had made 4 for 10. And, you know, since then, he's just kind of been on a roll. The volume has been going up. You know, he was pretty quiet in the early part of the season. So finding a shooter for them has been a big deal. But, you know, it's tough to win games in the ACC when you have one shooter. You know, Florida State has been in that position in the past, and you know, it didn't really work out well. And, you know, you look at Florida State, and we've always got like 3 40% shooters on the floor pretty much at all times, you know, and they've got one. But so can we find him while also, you know, being in position to win the rebounding battles? That's kind of the trick.
Defensively, North Carolina has been good, better. They're better defensively than they are offensively. I don't know that there's anything that they do defensively that really makes me feel like if Florida State plays its game, they should be, you know, I feel like that's more of a, is Florida State executing and making the extra pass, or maybe not making the extra pass, but making the right pass and shooting when they're actually open.
Yeah, and then, you know, we did talked about offensive rebounding for North Carolina, who's the number one team in the ACC. You know, number two in ACC play is Florida State. You know, so we're pretty reliant on offensive rebounding as well. You know, so that rebounding battle that we were talking about is on both sides of the floor. But, you know, you kind of hit the nail on the head, is that, you know, the primary difference between this team is that Florida State's a great shooting team. And if we have a great shooting night, you know, then it's lights out for North Carolina. You know, but if we, you know, we've struggled a little bit on the road, are we going to really be able to knock down a bunch of threes? It's, you know, it's tough to say.
Yeah, just a little reminder that in the first game, Florida State went 26 of 27 from the free throw line. First of all, great getting the line 27 times, and making 96% is obviously always a good thing. And 8 of 16 from the three. So it's not like we didn't shoot well the first time and we won by, again, 7. I don't know that either of those are going to be repeatable on the road. Maybe 40% from three. I don't know. 50 seems just kind of a stretch in any game, but I don't know that UNC is going to shoot 10 of 24 from three either. So if I had to say, I'm thinking a little bit maybe of a lower scoring game than the first one, which was 82-75. Although, you know, North Carolina does like to push tempo, and we certainly have no problem playing an up pace game either. But what do you think, Michael? Do you think is this game going to be a little lower scoring?
Well, these games are usually fun, you know, which is a good thing for college basketball. You know, Florida State, North Carolina, they both get up and down the floor. Both are trying to slow the other team down defensively. So, you know, I could see the game being a little lower scoring, but that's going to be reliant on, you know, us not hitting threes. I have a hard time picturing anyone holding Florida State below a point per possession. I mean, I know it's going to happen, but just the way that we've been so efficient of late, you know, it's kind of hard to imagine Florida State not, you know, being somewhere around the 80-point mark in this game.
Yeah, fair enough. And I will say that first game, I think, as I recall now, there were a lot of fouls and stuff. That first game actually only had 70 possessions, which, funny enough, is below the average for UNC. So I would expect that number to be closer to 75 in this game. And so you could see fewer made threes, but a similar score anyways. All right. Let me put you on the spot then. Give me, let's say that Malik is out, but MJ plays, just for the sake of things. Give me your prediction.
I think we're in trouble if Osborne does not play, and I'll take North Carolina in a close one, like, you know, 79-77, something like that.
I think I'm going to agree. I didn't know you were going to I didn't expect you to take UNC, but I think there is something to the fact that UNC is playing for their season. And is that a bad thing that it takes that level of sort of desperation to motivate a team? Probably doesn't make me want to pick them in March, but I do think that there is something to be said for that. And if you remove a guy who plays half the game for us down low and is able to battle and be another force against the offensive rebounding machine that is North Carolina, I feel like that is not a good recipe. So I will say 80-76 UNC. But I don't want to end the pod on a sour note. So, you know, the game after UNC, we probably won't do a pod before then, but it's BC at home. BC is not very good. Are we going to beat BC?
As long as the game is played, yes, we beat BC.
All right. So if we do beat UNC, that would mean that we'd be coming home to, for the second year in a row, cut down the nets on an ACC regular season championship against the Boston College Eagles. I would have to imagine, I'm with you, we're going to win that game at home. Even if we lose to UNC, that is still a viable option since UVA lost to NC State, and they have to go on the road to play Louisville in their final game.
Yeah, it's kind of disappointing to you know, win the regular season against Boston College, but you know, at least whoever's making the banners gets to be pretty confident that they can go ahead and hang it up.
Are we at that point now where we're disappointed that we're only winning ACC regular season titles against we're only going back to back against Boston College?
Yeah, I guess we have gotten to that point, which feels a little I don't know, feels a little Gatorish or something to be that picky about things, but
and you then know, we're supposed to be better next year, right? We're supposed to bring in all these recruits and stuff. So
the combined 14 game winning streak over Miami and Florida, they can laugh at me for saying that you know, it's disappointing to do it over Boston College, but you know, good luck in the future.
Yeah. All right. Well, as always, it's been a pleasure, and hopefully my hope is that when we come back to do the next podcast, we are both talking about how wrong we were against the Tar Heels.
Absolutely.
For Michael, I'm Matt.